As a people of faith, grounded in our principles, we cultivate lives of meaning and reverence and depth. We create sanctuary where all hands are held. Together we act toward justice and healing and sustainability. We create sanctuary. What a remarkable spiritual task to find within and among ourselves that sacred, safe refuge, that place of sanctuary. Sanctuary for other people who have no safety in their lives has been a theme throughout human history. Let me tell you how I got involved in the question to begin with. I was reading the story of Harriet Tubman to a kindergarten Sunday school class that I was teaching. Things were a little confused that morning, and the class next to us had somehow occupied the big play area that we needed the most, and we were getting a little nudgy. So I improvised a story about Harriet Tubman, the Moses of the Underground Railroad, coming to each child's door and knocking. It's dawn. Here she is. She has other people cowering in the shadows behind her. You know that people go to jail for helping slaves escape. You know it's against the law. Is there a higher law? You hear the knocking. What do you do? Do you go back to bed? Do you hide? Do you help her? What about the slave catchers just a block away? Hurry, there's not much time. Well, the kids tackled these problems. They all decided they were going to hide Harriet and all of the escaping slaves. Various ideas were put forward. The bathtub was a favorite. With cushions from the couch, that was popular. How to help her get to the next station of the Underground Railroad? One young son of a noted soprano soloist had the solution. Bring in a helicopter, only paint it black so no one can see it. And they tackled those problems with zest. No one doubted that Harriet Tubman and her band of passengers should be helped, but it gave me shivers because I kept double thinking. Would I let Harriet Tubman and the others in? Of course, with the advantage of 20/20 hindsight, with the approval of history, of course, but a refugee, an immigrant, someone speaking a different language, someone illegal, I began to appreciate the weight that our ancestors bore when they took the risk to harbor human beings. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 had made it illegal for anyone to house or transport a slave on their way to freedom. People throughout this country risked jail, risked fines, risked censure, loss of friends, loss of business, of livelihood, to help people because they wanted to live into the reality of the worth and dignity of every human being, something very like bringing heaven to earth. Moses brought his people, refugees, all into the promised land of freedom, which they felt was a sanctuary. Harriet Tubman sang his song, "Let My People Go." Yasay Barnwell from Sweet Honey in the Rock, a Unitarian Universalist, has written, "Would you harbor me?" And there's a chant, "Would you harbor me?" I have a really bad cold, so you're going to have to sing this. Would you harbor me? Would you harbor me? And then the next line is, would I harbor you? Would I harbor you? So if you'll just keep that going. Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay, or a trans person? Harbor me. Would I harbor? Would you? Would I harbor you? Recognizing the cross currents of passions and politics, laws that don't always agree with one another, which we see in this country, where we find the Geneva Convention requiring asylum to anyone who flees, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, nationality, or membership in a particular social group or political opinion, contradicted by national or state practices or cultures. As far back as human history records, these cross currents have existed. Egyptian, Greek, and Roman civilizations afforded safe places, sanctuaries, at the foot of the statues of their gods and goddesses. There, if you could get to the statue and reach out and touch the foot, the hem of the garment, some part of the image of the divine, you would be safe from all things found in the world. The sense was that divinity is contagious. If you touch the statue, if you reach the altar, you too are imbued with divine energy, and it's a sacrilege for anyone to try to molest you. The Jews of ancient Israel around the 7th century before the Common Era set up entire cities to be places of sanctuary, which contained important temples and imparted to all residents an alternative reality, an alternative to civil life. Sanctuary was not confined to those cities. In other places in ancient Israel, one could find refuge by entering the temple and grasping the horns which were built into the corners of the square altar. But you were only safe as long as you were hanging on to those. Eating or other life functions were a problem, from which possibly comes the phrase the horns of a dilemma. In medieval times, the place of sanctuary remained at the altar and then extended to include the entire church building as a consecrated building. People could be excommunicated or killed for violating sacred space by taking someone forcibly out of sanctuary. Later, the holy ground was extended to the courtyard as well, giving people a place to eat and sleep other than in the front of the altar, which had been making conducting services considerably more difficult. Sanctuary became such a strong element of religious tradition that it was incorporated into secular law. Medieval canon law and English common law ensured that every church was a potential sanctuary. Early Unitarians sought refuge from imprisonment and death at the hands of dominant Trinitarians throughout the 16th and 17th centuries. They were housed by friends and patrons who put their reputations and fortunes on the line for these visionaries. During the 17th century, the entire North American continent was seen as a sanctuary from the religious and political persecutions of Europe. Sanctuary became a part of the accepted understanding of what it meant to be on American soil by people here and around the world, engraved in the Statue of Liberty. You're tired, you're poor, your huddled masses, those yearning to breathe free. In 1836, Unitarian minister Charles Fallon said of slavery, but it applies to all of our seekings for sanctuary, we are told we must not agitate. We particularly must not agitate on particular subjects. We must leave them alone. They will remedy themselves. But I say unto you, this is not the course of providence. Such reformations are never accomplished without human means. God will not indulge us in our indolence, nor do the work without our instrumentality. The work of creating sanctuary is ours, not imbued by the touching of a statue, where the contagion of divinity enters our body, but by the contagion of the joy and light within each and every one of us, the unique and brilliant color of our particularity, which gives us the energy, the right indeed, the mandate to create wherever we go, sanctuary. More recently, during World War II, monasteries took in Jews in Nazi Germany. And sanctuary meant providing false documents, opening a door, or sharing a scrap of food. An entire village in France, Le Chambon, echoing the ancient Israelite cities of sanctuary. From December 1940 to September 1944, 5,000 people in the village and on the surrounding plateau provided refuge for an estimated 5,000 people, including an estimated 3,000 to 5,000 Jews who were fleeing from the Vichy authorities and the Germans. Elizabeth Conant Kaufman, a former child refugee in La Chambon, said, "Nobody asked who was Jewish and who was not. Nobody asked us where we were from. Nobody asked who your father was or if you could pay. They just took us in. They accepted each of us, taking us in with warmth, sheltering children, often without their parents, children who cried in the night from nightmares. They gave us sanctuary." The sanctuary movement, both new and old, continues in unabated strength. Most recently, the sanctuary movement finds some of its roots in the liberation theology movement of the Catholic Church in Latin America in the 1950s and 60s, a moral reaction to the poverty and social injustice. The term was coined in 1971 by the Peruvian priest Gustavo Gutierrez, who wrote one of liberation theology's most defining books, The Theology of Liberation, based on an understanding of history in which the human being is seen as assuming conscious responsibility for human destiny. He coined the phrase preferential option for the poor, implying that God's love excludes no one. Not surprisingly, Latin American liberation theology met opposition. It was accused of using Marxist concepts. It upset the authorities of the time. And in the 1980s, many Unitarian Universalist congregations were actively involved in the sanctuary movement. I ran into it when I was a seminarian at the Baptist Church in Cambridge, where for the first time in my life, having been raised Unitarian and then Unitarian Universalist, I decided to take communion because it made sense. A woman was there, Maria, from El Salvador. She had to leave her children behind. Her husband and her brother and her father had all been murdered. She barely escaped in the night through the most trying of circumstances and was housed in the basement of the church, which claimed the ancient rite of sanctuary. When we gathered together, we understood that bringing food and blankets and money was illegal and that our lives were on the line. To some degree, however much our culture was going to be respecting that sense of sanctuary. And so when she offered to us who had attended the meal, the bread and the wine, which to her in her Catholic faith represented the very body of that which sacrificed itself for the good of others, I got it. And when she gave me a piece of bread and said, "This is my body," and had me sip wine, "This is my blood," I felt something real. Real in the room which inhabited that ritual. I've never had communion since. And whenever I do next, I hope that it will mean as much as that moment did to me when this woman with her life on the line spoke to me as part of a body of faith. As a people of faith, grounded in our principles. "Turn not away the stranger at your door," says the Hebrew Bible, "lest you turn away an angel unawares." An angel, the etymology comes from messenger. Turn not a stranger from your door, lest there is a message from the universe waiting for you in this moment from that person in ways you may never have expected that will shatter your prejudices and create a new world where peace can walk softly through these rooms. Touching our lips with holy wine, making every casual corner bloom into a shrine. In the shrine of the ancient Jewish temple of the Israelites in Jerusalem, in the room within the room within the room within the room, the Holy of Holies, the Sanctum Sanctorum, there were four pillars with a tent covering over a table. The holiest of holies, the most sacred of sanctuaries, and on the table sat the covenant. To the ancient Israelites, those were the Ten Commandments. To us, a covenant is the sacred promises that we make one to another. When we promise to one another to be and to remind each other of our highest aspirations, our holiest intentions. When we remember whose am I? To whom do I belong? To whom do I give my deepest allegiances? Congregational polity tells us that we serve a mission, something greater than any one of us, but inclusive of all of us. Here, our mission is that we are empowered by love to transform ourselves to welcome in the unexpected angels in our midst and to serve our world. We got together as a number of ministries a couple weeks ago and worked a little bit more on the covenant that you have as a congregation, a beautiful statement of agreements about how we shall walk together, the way we shall be together. And ringing like a bell through every one of the inputs was the word respect, respect, respect. All of the many and miraculous ways that we can think up to express respect to one another. We'll work on it some more. Do come to the next ministries gatherings as we deepen our covenant and remember its roots in the creation of sanctuary, the creation of the holiest of holies, for these are times which need us badly, need us deeply, need us to be one people together, united. Martha Snyder gave me this newsletter clipping from Indianapolis around 1911. Just to remind us that the times of the world are difficult then and now, and we are needed. It turns out that one Mrs. Catherine N. Snyder was giving talks at the Universalist Church. And I'll read you a bit from the newspaper article. A series of sermons by Catherine N. Snyder, modestly announced several weeks ago, have created an unusual amount of interest throughout the city and the Universalist Church at 15th and New Jersey Streets, which threatens to be too small to accommodate the growing attendance. The next sermon in her series will be delivered Sunday at 11 o'clock, and the subject is Gulfs to be Bridged. And the discussion will deal with the difference between commercialized and Christianized society. The attitude and spirit of large corporations in Indianapolis, wherein the public is daily robbed by being taxed on criminally fictitious values or brutally imposed upon when much opposition is offered, as is the case of the Indianapolis Traction Company toward its employees, the greatest truth within the comprehension of man is that there is but one way to serve, and that is in serving your fellow human beings. Those words in 1911 are no less needed now, as Catherine N. Snyder reminded us, that we must work to create the space where consumerism and commercialization is not our guiding rule. Instead, we are committed to one another and to deepening our sense of safety, of refuge, and of sanctuary. Robin and I will end together. This is a reading from Erica Hewitt. I don't have anything to say.
Well, I do, but it might not be interesting to anyone.
I have secrets inside of me and struggles, and I don't know if I'm ready to share them.
I want to hear what you have to say.
I want to speak of the deepest things together.
I want to hear what you dream about, what you hope for.
I want to know how you have come to arrive at this resting place along your journey.
What if I speak and you don't understand me?
I will listen, and listen again and again until my hearing becomes understanding.
What if I can't find the words to share the world inside of me?
I believe that wise words will emerge from you.
How can I trust you to hold my life's stories? You, who I may not even know.
By knowing that, as I receive part of your story, I will give you part of mine.
How will this work? What will happen? What awaits us?
We can find out anything by beginning.
Let us begin to listen and trust and to know one another more deeply.